Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien, along with Dave Ross and Chris Sullivan. The formula shortage just took another hit. Severe weather flooding the Abbott factory in Michigan, delaying the delivery again of formula to shelves of American grocery stores. But it's also keeping the conversation about formula and breastfeeding in the forefront and what we expect of mothers, too. Alyssa Rosenberg, she's a columnist in the opinion section for The Washington Post. Alyssa, good morning. I am so impressed with the data set you are presenting in your column.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Why don't you describe exactly what you did?
So I had been covering the formula shortage sort of in a series of reported columns. And as I was watching the national conversation emerge, there was this one through line response to the formula shortage that just set my hair on fire. And it was just breastfeed. Breastfeeding is free. Breastfeeding is natural. Women's bodies are designed for breastfeeding. And, you know, my colleague Monica Hess had written a really great column about a year ago where she said, breastfeeding is only free if a mother's time is worth nothing. Mm. And a light bulb went off in my head a little bit since I've breastfed both of my children. My oldest is 4. My youngest is 8 months. And I use a simple tracker to time feedings. And some of that is because for those of you who don't know, babies don't necessarily eat at both breasts in a single feeding. You want to make sure that you alternate so you don't get engorged or uncomfortable on one side. And so I had just been doing this sort of reflexively, but it made me realize that I had this enormous data set that most women don't have. And so that I could quantify how much money I'd spent breastfeeding for the first 6 months of my son's life, and not just how much time I'd spent, but how that time was distributed throughout the day. And so fortunately, I was able to export that data from my app to Yan Wu, an amazing data scientist who works with me here at The Post. And she was able to calculate just down to the minute how much time I'd spent nursing and pumping, but also to visualize how that time had that investment of time had changed over that 6 months, and also when those nursing and pumping sessions happened in a day. So we were able to take real concrete data, obviously from one woman's experience, and show people how, you know, the cost in time that a mother spends breastfeeding. And then we built this really clever calculator where you could plug your salary into it and see if you were being paid for breastfeeding and pumping the way you were paid for your job, what that time would be worth. And I think people found that to be a really powerful way to sort of put money on this experience that is treated as if it's valuable, but also because it's so valuable that you shouldn't think about sort of the time or the cost or the sacrifices involved in doing it. So I was lucky to have the data set. I was lucky to have colleagues who could help me sort of make it visible. But I've heard a lot from readers that they've just never seen someone quantify their experiences that way before.
Right. I had the same experience looking at it because I know I felt it. I know that the responses I get from people when I describe the struggle of breastfeeding aren't satisfactory. So to see your data set out there and you know, watch similar to my experience how it played out and what that's worth, it was really powerful. Why do you think people need to see this data? What do you want to see out of it?
What I'd really like to see and what I argued in the column is, you know, if breastfeeding is so valuable, if breast milk is the healthiest, most important thing for babies to be eating, I would like to see a massive realignment of policy in a way that makes it easier for women to breastfeed or to exclusively pump if that's what they have to do. And that involves a lot of changes, right? It starts with paid parental leave, because if you have to go back to work 6 weeks after you have a baby, you may not have breastfeeding fully established. If your child has a tongue or a lip tie, that may not have been fully resolved. You know, your milk supply may not have been regulated, or you may not be going back to a job where you have adequate accommodations for pumping. Obviously, second, I mean, I think every workspace where it's at all possible to do that needs to have a, you know, clean, comfortable, dedicated pumping space, since right now all that's required by federal law is that, you know, the place where you're pumping be private and have a door. You're not even required to have a sink to wash your pump part. And then you know, I think there are a lot of other little changes, right? Obviously, I think lactation support should be much more available, since breastfeeding, for all that it's natural, and I put that in air quotes, is actually something that can be very easy to get wrong or have not quite work.
That was the biggest lie, I feel like. I was told as a new mom, or I assumed as a new mom, that breastfeeding would just happen.
You know, I didn't know before I was a mom and was in mother's groups that what determines your milk production is not, you know, the size of your breasts, but whether you have a certain amount of, like, specific milk-producing tissue, right? Mm-hmm. And I have friends who don't have enough of that tissue in either breast, simply could not produce the food that their children needed to survive. And, you know, in an entirely natural society without formula, her kids would be dead, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's latching that, like, adequately. Babies have tiny mouths. They may not actually latch correctly onto you, and you can end up torn up because of that. And so I think there is just astonishing ignorance, even among those of us who, you know, take breastfeeding classes before we have babies.
Yes.
You know, until you really get in the weeds, there's so much that you can't know. But anything we could do to make the sort of the mechanics, the time commitment, the nutritional requirements for mom, any of those things that we could make more visible would be a huge contribution to reducing ignorance and making mothers feel more supported. And I, you know, I've also been really heartened to hear, you know, dads speaking up in the formula debate. You know, there have been members of Congress who have talked about, you know, having to, even in times when there weren't shortages, having to drive around to find special formula for their kids. You know, you have fathers talking about the strain of having to constantly be refreshing e-commerce sites to see if they can buy any formula at all while they're at work. You know, I mean, breastfeeding makes feeding a baby primarily a mother's responsibility, mm-hmm. but both parents, I mean, any two-parent household knows what it's like to deal with a hungry baby and that sort of primal urge to keep your baby fed.
Yeah. Yeah. It gave me kind of goosebumps, chills when you said that primal urge to keep your baby fed. Too soon for me. My youngest is 3 years old and it still brings back memories of those cries. So Alyssa Rosenberg, you can find her article in the Washington Post. She's a columnist there, and read it. Spread it around. It's important information for everybody to understand. Alyssa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map. It's a quick look at stories behind local places and things. And this week, a unique border crossing in eastern Washington that features its own international airstrip.
Yeah, I know. Then this story's a bit of a follow-up. During the pandemic, we checked in with several Washington border towns, see how they were doing and learn a little bit more about the history. You know, Point Roberts was getting all the attention. We wanted to look into some of these other places. We did Danville and Northport and Medellin Falls. But we didn't get to one of my favorites, the community of Laurier, which is north of Spokane in Ferry County. For some reason, it's named after Victorian-era Canadian Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier.
Okay.
Downright un-American. They ought to put a stop to that. Let's get a petition started. No. It's also on the far north end of U.S. Highway 395.
Uh-huh.
That's a road we talked about a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Down there. Anyway, it's all tied together, this
get
history
your tricks
stuff. You can't
on
avoid
Route 395,
it. That's the one.
It?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're Route 695 because of the price of gas. So at Laurier, there's a cool 1930s building that houses the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. It's similar to other structures from that era that they built all along the northern international boundary, from Washington all the way across the continent. But what really sets Laurier apart is this airstrip. It's called AV Field in honor of a late longtime state legislator, Arthur Kootenay AV of nearby Kettle Falls. It was dedicated back on July 11th, 1963, with all kinds of dignitaries on hand, including our old Senator Scoop Jackson. The airstrip was built by something called the old Washington Aeronautics Commission. That's been folded into WashDOT, but it was part of a statewide effort to create airstrips along popular aviation routes in rural and mountainous areas that could serve as an emergency landing option for small planes, but also to encourage recreational aviators to visit out-of-the-way places. They built more than a dozen, as far as I can tell, around the state, places like Lester on Stampede Pass, Bandera on Snoqualmie Pass, and Nason Creek near Stevens Pass. Bob Davis is the manager of the airstrip at Laurier.
It's really a nice little field. It's a nice rock packed in solid. We were talking about paving it 1 year, and that never came to pass. But the state was going to pave it. They wanted to do a lot of improvements, but my father-in-law wanted to keep it kind of basic, like it was meant to be, is what he said.
So AV Field stands out because the northern section of the runway actually crosses into British Columbia.
Hmm.
So on the U.S. side of the border, U.S. Customs at Laurier will screen travelers as they head south by automobile, and staff offers the same service to travelers arriving by air. And Canadian officials do the same at the north end of the gravel runway, where the border station is known as Cascade. Now, it's not owned by Washington State anymore. 10 years ago, they sold Davie Field to the Slagle family. That we heard from a moment ago, Bob Davis. He's the Slagle's son-in-law. And it's just a place you can fly in anytime. It's like a free recreational field. Depending on the snow, it's generally open to the public from roughly June 1st to October 1st every year. Now, I'm not an aviator. I like flying, but I've never been to Laurier. But I definitely want to drive up there and see it. Because this idea of an airport that starts in one country and ends right. in another... What a kooky idea.
It seems like a dangerous invitation, too, right?
Yeah.
Like a barefoot bandit invitation.
Yeah, maybe. That's not a bad idea. But anyway, one of these cool little border towns that you don't hear as much about as some of these other places like Blaine or Point Roberts, but certainly worth knowing about these parts of Washington that have been along that international boundary since the 1850s.
Now I just need a friend with an airplane.
Exactly.
Here's starring Felix Bonnell. All his features at MyNorthwest.com. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Joining us, the host of CBS's Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. I'm sure you've been watching the January 6th committee. I was surprised to see that Donald Trump apparently issued a tweet asking for equal time. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. But there is quite a lot of time being spent in sworn testimony and depositions that have been played back on tape before Congress. So I'm sure the committee would welcome the president to come under sworn oath and testify
that's
before them with equal time. But
that's not
what he's offering.
I'm pretty sure he has an open invitation on Face the Nation to do that, right?
Yes, he would, as would the vice president, Mike Pence, who sent some of his former aides and has not appeared himself, though he was the subject of most of yesterday's testimony.
Yeah. Explain, please, the Ginny Thomas situation. She's the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and her activism in the Stop the Steal effort. And why is that a problem?
Well, you know, this is something that we now expect the committee to delve into next week, potentially, and beyond. But we don't know a lot yet, to be very frank. What we know through text messages, through emails that Ginny Thomas, Clarence Thomas's wife, have been released now, that she was in contact with some of these Trump lawyers, including the architect of this scheme to try to get Vice President Pence to pick and choose which electoral votes to count. In other words, hand select the next president. So there is some interesting language that was used in some of these depositions that we heard yesterday, where John Eastman, this legal scholar and architect who came up with this deeply flawed plan, was telling individuals that he was confident that the Supreme Court, that he could actually, if their case went there, he could get at least two votes, but he was confident in many ways that the court wouldn't take up the case, that they would pass on it. Or allowing for their scheme to work. And so that raises questions of why was he confident? Was the fact that he was in contact with Ginny Thomas somehow an indicator of a back channel or some indicator of perhaps where that justice's head was? But this is all speculative. I want to be clear at this point. Based on the exchanges, John Eastman has said in a public posting that this was, you know, an innocent discussion with Ginny Thomas about coming to speak to a group she was a member of and not part of a broader scheme.
So how is this playing in Washington, D.C.? It certainly hasn't been helping Joe Biden's poll numbers. They're still as bad as they always were. Is this, I don't know, is it sufficiently frightening to the people in power that they're going to do something to make sure it doesn't happen again?
Well, you know, these hearings now are happening in the middle of the day, not just prime time. For people like me, it's important to cover and pour through the detail. I realize people at home aren't. That's why on Sunday we want to pull through the main takeaways that are important for you to know, because it gets confusing. This was a pretty hackneyed scheme, right? It was a gambit here by John Eastman and the former president to come up with this plan. But when you hear all the details, for example, that like we did yesterday, of what happened on January 6th, that the vice president woke up that morning with a phone call from President Trump bullying him, calling him names, pressuring him one-on-one to refuse used to certify the election to subvert the Constitution, to take an illegal action just because he wanted him to. And Mike Pence had said, and we learned that through all of his aides and lawyers who testified yesterday, had said again and again and again, no, Mr. President, this is not my role. This is not what I can actually do. You are wrong. And in fact, that President Trump had been told by lawyers that this was illegal. And yet that pressure campaign continued. And over the course of his day, Mike Pence's life was threatened. And we know that. And we saw these pictures of him hovering, huddling, I should say, in the basement of the Capitol while these mobs searched for him. And that we now know, based on court documents, members of the Proud Boys, that far right group, had discussed killing him if they'd captured him. And at one point, the mob came within 40 feet. So hearing all this detail laid out, it shows that there was indeed an elaborate plan to steal the election. And it was a plan laid out by President Trump and his allies. And it involved the pressure of violence, if not the direct threat of it.
The thing that scared me is that it's pretty clear the only thing protecting the Constitution is the willingness of the people who swear the oath.
Yes.
To live up to that oath. That's it.
Yes. Ultimately, those who want to put a positive spin on this would say, and that's what won the day, that it was individuals like the Secret Service agents who swore to protect the vice president, who whisked him to security, who, you know, he refused to leave on site, he said, because he didn't want leaders around the world watching the vice president fleeing the United States Capitol for his own safety. He knew that that would be damaging to America in the long run. So those are the things that really do remind us all that, you know, it's up to us to really be civic minded and to uphold these values that we say we're about as a country.
Margaret Brennan, the host of CBS's Face the Nation. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. It's taken more than 40 years, but the loved ones of two missing people have finally gotten some closure. Advances in DNA technology helped the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office identify a John and Jane Doe, victims in separate cases. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. You know, when we're talking about advances in DNA technology and cold cases, it's, for me, always about genetic genealogy. That's what we're talking about here. Snohomish County Sheriff's Department has really been a leader in the genetic genealogy, which, just for background, is when you don't have a match, when you have DNA from a crime scene, but you don't have a suspect or something in the national database that they check those things against, that can help solve cold case murders. It's also used to identify people whose bodies were found and who were never identified that were decades old. So we've seen a lot of that as well. And what they do is if they can't find a match in the system anywhere, they can have labs that extract DNA, create a profile that gives kind of specific traits of a person. And if other people in the public have uploaded their, like, for ancestry sites, GEDmatch, places like that, they can find a match that way, a familiar match, and then kind of reverse engineer it backwards
to track down
who that is.
I didn't realize
that.
So the police actually have access to these gene sites where people submit their genetic material voluntarily?
Yes, you'll remember it was first used in the Golden State Killer case, and there was some privacy concerns, and they put a box on the form that pretty much wiped that issue out. So people have to opt in, and it's all taken care of. So here we're talking about a couple of cases where people were Jane and John Doe's that were found decades ago, more than 40 years ago. Nicole Darty, she's with the Snohomish County Medical Examiner's Office, and she describes the circumstances of our first case, the John Doe, 45 years ago.
On September 7th, 1977, a bulldozer operator in the Marysville landfill discovered human remains. The coroner at the time, Bob Phillips, opined that the decedent had been deceased for approximately 2 weeks. The sheriff's office determined the refuse in the landfill was exclusively from businesses in Seattle, and there was no residential trash from the local area. The next day, September 8th, Dr. James Lippo performed an autopsy and noted extensive postmortem trauma due to compaction and bulldozing processes at the landfill. The cause of death was undetermined due to the trauma and the postmortem interval. The manner of death was listed as homicide.
They were unsuccessful after trying for years to identify him. They eventually, you know, got the, his body was exhumed, I believe, in 2010. And for years after, they sent bones to labs trying to get the right DNA out to get a profile created. And finally, last year,
in January 2021, a section of the femur was sent to Othram for extraction, testing, and upload to genealogical databases. Analysis of the DNA indicated the decedent to be predominantly Native American. Snohomish County Medical Examiner's Office uploaded the profile obtained from Othram to GEDmatch, and on GEDmatch, a match was found at the Great Niece level. Snohomish County Medical Examiner's Office built family trees with the help of genealogist Martha Thompson Coleman of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe in South Dakota and relatives. Through family history, the Snohomish County Medical Examiner's Office determined that Blaine House Turks disappeared in 1977 when he hopped a train to Spokane, Washington with his brother Clayton.
They had come from North Dakota, so the brother had left a couple of years later, they eventually determined. And at some point, he ended up in a dumpster in Seattle. That's what they're talking about there, that they determined where the trash was. And ended up in the landfill. They say this could have been a situation where he had been intoxicated and maybe passed out in there, but it was classified a homicide, no suspects or anything like that. But closure for his relatives, who had known for years, a lot of them younger relatives at this point, but they were able to, from that great niece level, track down who this was and finally identify him.
Wow.
Sheriff Fortney of the Snohomish County Sheriff's Department describes our second case.
The second case we're here to talk about today. In 2009, partial human remains were discovered by the U.S. Forest Service employees in a steep ravine near Beckler Road, north of Skykomish. For 13 years, those remains have been a Jane Doe. Due to incredible investigative work by the Medical Examiner's Office and advancement in DNA technologies, the remains have been identified as Alice Williams, who went missing in 1981.
She went missing under suspicious circumstances from her cabin. There was a suspect in her disappearance at the time. They didn't know that her body had been found, but that person has since passed away. Again, though, they've got some closure for the family, and it's all because of the work they did in this case with Offram Labs. It's an out-of-state lab where they do this extraction of the DNA from the bones and create the profile. David Middleman is with that lab. And says that it's incredible work.
Both of these cases are cases that involve, you know, very old skeletal remains. They were very hard to work, and there was many attempts that were made. So I just want to point out a couple things that some of these cases, they seem intractable, they seem impossible, but they're all possible. And it just takes, you know, the right purposeful forensic testing to make them work. That's something that we do at Offram, and we've done very successfully with Jim and Jane, many of the folks at the Medical Examiner's Office and Sheriff's Office.
So he seems to be saying no matter how impossible it seems, it's always possible?
Right. That was really the message yesterday from everyone, including the gentleman I'm about to introduce you to here, Detective Jim Sharp. He has been in charge of these types of cases. He's been the head of the cold case unit there at the sheriff's office since 2005. And he is the one who kind of brought genetic genealogy into Washington State.
In 2018, we learned of a new tool called genetic genealogy. I learned it from Barbara Ray Venter, who was the genealogist behind the capture of the Golden State Killer. Since then, I've been working with teams from different labs to get DNA profiles from evidence left at crime scenes and from unidentified bodies that the County Medical Examiner's Office had jurisdiction over. We've exhumed about five of those bodies over the years, ended up solving five cases that we had evidence left at crime scenes, and now we've solved another 10 cases or more that were unidentified bodies, several of which were homicides and a few of them that were not.
And they have a few. So actually, when they did the initial case, which you'll recall a few years ago, was the Jay and Jay Cook, Tanya von Kahlenberg, who were the young British couple who came down from British Columbia. Canadian couple who came from British Columbia and were murdered in Seattle or near Seattle. That was the first case he did. That person ended up going on trial, being convicted through this. And he was supposed to retire when they first got kind of the wind of the genetic genealogy, and then he found out it could have so many implications for all of those cases you just heard him talking about. So he held off on his retirement for several years. He's actually now going to retire in a couple of weeks.
Just to be able to pursue these cases, huh?
Yes, and he's made a huge, huge difference. And I asked him yesterday, because I know back at the beginning, that's when I first met him in the Jay and Tanya case, and he, at the time, you know, genetic genealogy was new, there was concerns about how it would fly in court, all of that, and since then it's been used a lot in various parts of the country, but not everywhere. Not every department is aware, not every department knows what to do, and that includes in our own state. So the gentleman at the lab, David Middleman, he said yesterday that this actually is going beyond what we are seeing so far as its implication for cases, and it has implications for unsolved sexual assaults where people are not necessarily murdered. And they are partnering with our state attorney general with his Saki grant. That's the basically the rape kit grant to clear our backlog. So they're working on that level for that. And Jim Scharf says the AG's office is also going to be partnering with his replacement and trying to figure out how they can get more of this work done for cold cases across our state.
Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. In the Sacramento area, you'll find a boy with Down syndrome who knows exactly what he wants to do with life. CBS's Molly Real reports.
7-year-old Drew Bosman loves UPS.
Every time a UPS truck would go by, UPS!
His favorite color? Brown. His Halloween costume, you guessed it.
We got him a little uniform for Halloween, and it stuck. He started wanting to put it on and deliver packages to his friends, and he told everyone who would listen that he wants to be a UPS truck driver when he grows up.
And his mom, Becky, says it's because Drew says UPS delivers joy, which is fitting.
Joy is kind of my platform as it relates to Down syndrome, because to be honest, having a kid with Down syndrome has been the greatest source of joy in my life.
And today, UPS delivered something special to Drew, his biggest dream, to suit up in brown and bring parcels filled with presents to his peers.
We heard that he is loves delivering, loves UPS, and he loves bringing joy to for what we do to other people.
In a miniature truck decorated with flames and filled with packages, UPS driver Ian Geddes drove Drew to his school, Caleb Greenwood, living his dream, delivering joy. Drew's mom says joy is the delivery he makes every day.
That's what Drew's here to do. He does it to everybody he meets. What? And it just moves you to tears.
That is CBS's Molly Real. Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien, along with Dave Ross. And the co-host of the Jake and Stacy Show on 710 Seattle Sports is joining us this morning. It's Jake Heaps, because he has a brand new assignment, and it's the coach for Russell Wilson. How did you land this?
Well, it's something that I've been doing for 5 years now with Russell, and honestly, we've been able to kind of make two passions work here. So I've been doing the, you know, the Seattle sports side of things, and have fallen in love with that. As a former player, the radio gig was not something that I was thinking that I was going to get into. You know, I got a call from Brock Huard 5 years ago and said, hey, would you be able to fill in for me? And I said, yeah, sure. I don't know what this means, but I'll fill in for you. And just instantly had this connection, just loved it, and loved being able to just love the ability to connect with people and help people understand certain situations. And in sports radio, that's what you're doing. You're analyzing, you're reacting, you're, you know, talking through things. And it was just super fun. So was able to make both of those things work at the same time, working with Russell, training him in the off season, and it worked very much in sync. You know, everything was here in Seattle, right? And obviously when the trade happened in Denver, my initial reaction was, all right, how do we make both work, and how do we figure out how to make that happen? And, you know, as months gone on and came to fruition that it just wasn't going to happen. So super excited about this opportunity to go full time, 2 feet into the coaching world, something I'm super passionate about, but it is sad. I have to say, we've worked very hard on the Jake and Stacy Show the last 3 years, and we've developed something special, and it's going to be tough to leave, but very excited for what's next.
So you're a quarterback for college teams, you're a quarterback professionally too in the NFL. So how did you hook up with Russell?
In my second year as a pro, I was with the Seahawks in 2016, and I was just a guy trying to crack the roster, right? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to make the roster, and being able to be signed back to my hometown team that I loved. I mean, it was an amazing feeling. But Russell and I really connected over the work, over the process. And he saw that I was just as diligent, just as focused as he was. every single day. We really became close over the 2 years that I was, you know, in and out of the building in Seattle. And then after I was done in 2017, Russell called me and said, hey, I want you to train me. I want you to come train me.
And what does that involve? I mean, Trevor Moab was sort of his guru, right, in terms of making sure that he could concentrate on the job to be done without getting distracted. Mm-hmm. So where did you play into that?
The way I played into it, so, you know, Trevor, you know, he really focused on the mental side of the game, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, what I do is I make sure that mechanically, with the biomechanics, the way he moves, basically the way he throws, making sure that he's on point and that there isn't any fundamental flaw that is holding him back from performing at his best. And then also to prep him to be game ready. When he's game one, we want him to be already in mid-season form.
You even sound a little like him when you talk, right? That optimistic, never-ending drive and all of that.
All business.
What do you wish people knew about Russell the way you know him?
I think one of the things that I wish people knew about him is that he is genuine. And people always, the first question that I get asked by people is he really like that? Is he really this kind of a guy? And the answer is, yeah, he really is. And then the other part is that I don't think people understand how difficult it is to manage the expectations of playing at peak performance, then also being the face of the franchise and having all this weight and expectation on who you should be, how you should act, how you should conduct yourself, and that you're just never going to be enough for people. I think for Russell, the big part that I wish people could see is just him just relaxed and in his element and being who he is behind the scenes.
Why doesn't he show us that version then?
Well, he does and he doesn't, because I think one of the biggest parts of that is that if you want athletes' honest, true versions of themselves or their honest opinions, I think it rubs people the wrong way that, oh, no, you're not saying what I want you to say, or you're not doing things the way I want you to do them. And especially when you're a franchise quarterback, I think that you're always better to err on the side of caution and protect yourself than you are trying to open up and let people in. And that's just speaking honestly.
So what's your work day going to be like?
Well,
does he have his own practice facility at the house?
Oh, you guys would be blown away. I mean, it's like Candyland for an athlete. So he's got this unbelievable facility, state of the art, everything you could ever want, you know, from the field to the training aspect of it.
He's got a field?
Oh, yeah. He's got his own field. So we'll be working there a lot. I'm actually traveling to Europe next week because he's going to Europe and I have to train. Well, he's on vacation, he can't be on vacation. He's got to stay sharp. You know, I mean, we've got a game one, as we all know, here at Lumen Field coming up in a matter of months.
All right. You have 1 second to answer after I ask you this yes or no question.
Oh, boy.
The Seahawks going to beat the Broncos when they play him?
No.
Ah!
There you go.
Thought I could get you.
It's the honest answer. Now, as a Seahawks fan, I mean, it's like the worst thing in the world for me right now. And so I can't wait for week one to be over so I can get past all that and I could just, you know, go back to feeling good about being a Seahawks fan again and you know, I'll always and forever. The Denver Broncos, they got a really good roster. Adding Russ was a big deal. And the Seahawks are in a transition right now. And I'm really excited about what that's going to look like for them and what they're going to ultimately be when it's all said and done. But, you know, this is a transition year. And I think everybody will feel that.
All right. Jake Heaps, new full-time quarterback coach for Russell Wilson on the Denver Broncos, leaving 7-10. Jake, thank you.
Thank you. You can ring my
bell. Ring the bell. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here's Rachel Bell to tell us why the national parks are banning plastic.
Water bottles, single-use plastics. I am thrilled. Yeah. Yes. Well, there's always been this strange dichotomy of going into the wild and bringing with you a bunch of things that will never leave this earth, such as plastic water bottles. The thing I always think of is backpackers. Like, most backpackers go into the wild, you know, with their backpacking meals and their bars, and then you leave the wild with just a backpack full of plastic. So the national parks are saying by 2032, which, yes, it sounds a while away, but they got to make some plans, there will be no more water bottles, no more plastic, at least that they're going to sell. I don't know how it's going to work if they're going to, you know, you go through the gate and they're like, we got to inspect your bag, man. You can't bring that in here. But it's 480 million acres of federal land. And they're trying to be leaders in this, because I think what happens a lot is that we, the public, individual people, are made to feel like we have to do all of this ourselves, where I practice a lot of zero waste, but you know, it's nice, but it's the big companies and the big parks that they have to take the lead to make a difference. And so it's expected to reduce millions of pounds of plastic waste.
I was shocked to read an accompanying article which said that 9% of plastic is recycled. That's it, because the industry will not settle on a standard type of plastic. Ugh. And so just because you see the little recycling triangle doesn't mean it can be recycled. It has to be the right number. Nobody's going to do that.
And there's so many little things that I've learned, like you can't recycle the lids of plastic things. You can't recycle, you know, the little top of the milk, and most people don't know. And then, of course, a few years ago, we learned here in Seattle that we were sending it all to China, and they stopped accepting it. And so it's just not being recycled. So, yeah, it's better to not use it all.
I feel like everybody has those big metal canteen water bottles now, though, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you don't, you can get one for free by just like walking by a 5K and picking one up for yourself, right? Like they're just handing them out.
Bring back public water fountains that work.
Well, yes.
Remember, cities used to have public water fountains everywhere, and one by one, they broke and were never fixed.
Well, that's because somebody licked them and they had to take them all out. Yeah, that's actually a part of what they're talking about. So the first step now in the start of this 10-year process is just to brainstorm, and it's kind of basic stuff. They're saying, let's bring back more water fountains and also bottle filling stations like you see in SeaTac Airport. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy about this. I'm looking forward to it. We can't be trusted. We have to have things taken away from us to make the world a better place.
So let's talk about these polyamorous commitment ceremonies. Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is intriguing to me. So I am somebody who has been on dating apps recently, and I noticed that so many people write ENM on their profiles. That is ethical non-monogamy. That is now what you call an open marriage. That is the politically correct. And I'm telling you, when I'm looking through, it has to be at least 30% of the profiles are ethical non-monogamy. I'm not kidding. So there's this story in the Washington Post about the fact that, you know, for some people, ethical non-monogamy or polyamory means that you're in a committed relationship with one other person, but then you go out and you can have another relationship, whether it's committed or not. But this article is talking about people who want to become a three-person union.
Oh.
Everybody's in love. They want to live together. They want to commit as if they're all married. In some cases, they want to raise children together. So what do you do then? Because the law prohibits marriage for more than two people. So in the article, they're talking about a lot of people having commitment ceremonies, which doesn't do anything legally, but just helps that third person feel like they're more officially a part of what is usually starting as a couple, adding a third person in. In Somerville, Massachusetts, they're said to be the first U.S. city to legally recognize a polyamorous domestic partnership. And as far as the couple that was in this Washington Post article that wants to have kids together, they are working with, let's see, the Chosen Family Law Center to make sure they all have equal status as parents of their future child so that there will be legal protection there.
But it sounds to me like this is just a way to get everybody on the same health insurance policy.
It could be. That's all we all want in this country is health insurance.
This will be the way to get finally to national health insurance. We can all marry.
Yeah. So there is...
commit to each other.
Commit,
we can't
sorry.
Marry. We no, can okay. commit to one another.
There's a couple in Seattle who... I guess I could just say their names because they've been posting about it all over social media. Lindy West, who is a known writer, and she has some TV shows that are made after her books. Her and her husband are now in this three-person relationship. And the thing that is most fascinating to me is, how did you all fall in love and like each other? I mean, it's hard enough to find one person you want to spend the rest of your life with, but let alone that you all are in love in every angle of this relationship. Like, I just feel like that's actually quite... interesting.
Yeah, I imagine it's, you know, you found your person, as Lindy apparently did, but there are needs not getting met, where it's like, I need somebody who's a little more emotionally intelligent, but physically and fun and friendship-wise, you're the perfect husband or wife for me. And then you find your other person, and you're like, hey, you're the emotional intelligence I need. Let's
but
get
this
it
is
on.
More than, I mean, that sounds like a good friend. But these are now good friends who just all sleep in the same bed, right?
Sure.
Well, that comes with connection.
Well, what could go wrong with that?
I don't know, because I do not have ethical non-monogamy on my profile.
Back to my life. Back to my quiet life.
Yeah. But I just want to emphasize that I just think it's something we're not used to. I don't think it should be something that people are like, oh.
No. If everybody's in a loving relationship, more love. The world needs more love.
That's
go
what I'm
it.
Saying.
The world does need more love.
Yeah.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you. I love you guys.
I love you, too.
Well, to a point. To a point. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.